pointed his knife, and announced, "She's right there." Argento wouldn't look. Mr. Capellatio took a powerful step forward and raised the knife and said, "Last chance." He was not joking. Argento wouldn't look, and without ceremony, Mr. Capellatio brought the blade down, his face contorted by effort, but not emotion. And in the end, she couldn't look either, but hid her eyes in the shawl and wished she had never met Argento, so she wouldn't have to remember him. The wet sawing lasted much longer than he'd earned. The crowd cheered. The birds. Summer came and went, and though Mr. Capellatio tried to keep her from the unpleasantness of the executions, she always heard the beheadings and that gasping mob, their breath released together as laughter, because laughter was all they could muster. He left her alone in the afternoons, when he left with bags of magic paraphernalia and returned bloody in the evenings. She walked around this new camp with an audacity she'd never had at her brother's carnival. She belonged to Mr. Capellatio, and so everyone treated her well, and this knowledge shamed her because she felt so safe, and sometimes also it caused a twinge of excitement deep in her belly. There was a tent full of dancing girls, not much older than herself, and they caused fights between the men and even some of the crones, who considered them like daughters, and fought over which one was the prettiest or the best dancer. The girl liked to spy on them. She watched them draw on each other's faces before they performed, butterflies and stars, and once she heard them singing together in such a crystalline collective voice that it was like a knife in her chest. She imagined herself with them, laughing and shimmying on stage for the men, but stopped her spying when she realized she was jealous. And sometimes, because she missed Argento, she went to watch the headmakers at their task, chanting in chalk and braids and blood. Heads were bought and sold at the booths, spines removed, ground, burned, eaten, sigils etched into dead flesh, and live flesh. These headmakers didn't venerate the astronauts or the hexagram that symbolized the six towers at the Cape. Their brand was a rocket ship, and there were booths devoted to each of the space rockets. The man in charge of the largest booth had a red beard and black hair, and he was a ratty, skinny thing, but the way he said,
"Oh, Queenie, you tell Mr. King I took extra special care with those heads he brought in the other day,"
was genuine and kind. And his smile had a black front tooth, but the way he smiled made her want to smile back. She was not afraid. Even when he held a freshly beheaded body over a basin to collect its blood, he said. Collecting blood had been illegal in Argento's carnival, because according to Wonderblood, the blood from the dead was supposed to saturate the earth. She had thought it was illegal everywhere because of the primary law, and wondered if the people in this carnival were happier because Mr. Capellatio was a blessed redeemer, or because he let them break the law. Mr. Capellatio himself, though, confused her more day by day. He often took her outside to present the sky to her like a gift, something made special by his attention, and he bore it upward on his palms so familiarly, like it was his. "Like a deep, dark sapphire," he'd say, "is the sky. Like the sea." They stood on a butte under the stars, at the center of five pikes and heads, on these breezy summer nights. He could talk in such a beautiful way. It was hard not to listen. He kept his fingers clasped around her shoulders so tight it hurt, and he said hypnotizing things like, "This field used to be underwater. Extraordinary how the world reinvents itself. Inspiring. Promising." Once, during a moment of mad, terrible loneliness, she'd asked, "Do you believe that magic is real? My mother told me it's all just lunatic ravings." They were staring at the stars, like always. His mood darkened almost imperceptibly, but then he laughed, rattled her hard. "My queenlet, are we not born in blood and pain? Is this not how we are squeezed grossly into the world? So then how should we atone for the sins of our past if what we desire is a new world order? Magic is about balance, Sugarplum. If we once leached, now we must gush." He shrugged. "Your mother must have been a fool's bitch to believe otherwise. is all I'll say about her." She'd heard in his voice a trill of almost laughter, which made her wonder if he was saying what he thought a king would say, and not what he truly believed. She searched his face for lies, and thought she saw many. Then he smiled cruelly and said, "You should believe in magic. You are magic. So if you don't believe in it, where will you be? Will you not exist?" He mockingly put a hand to his lips and made a surprised face. "Can a thing exist if we don't believe it?" She had narrowed her eyes at this, unsure if he was making fun of her. He hadn't touched her. At night, he sat cross-legged on his bed with a lantern, gazing at his many books, often with a puzzled expression, but always with a singularity of purpose that troubled her. He'd be flayed alive by his constituents, he'd mutter, if he did not have all the answers by the time they arrived at the Cape. But she didn't know what he meant. He asked her direct questions that made no sense, like, "Can you see me dying? How do you think I might die if I were to die in, say, 2 months?" Which was how long it was until they broke camp and headed south instead of north, until they broke the law and went forth to meet their destinies with brave hearts. He forced her to predict his death in as many ways as she could dream up, each more horrible than the last, until he sighed with a satisfaction that was nearly sexual, and that frightened her, because he'd never reached for her physically, never even tried. That troubled her. She began to believe he wanted something much more awful. In October, they broke camp and marched over the plain, fast, too fast, because they'd waited so late in the season, and soon they were riding in cold rain against the wind, and she was miserable, wet, freezing, even in Mr. Capellatio's wagon, where his charms hung from the ceiling, tinkling and catching the lamplight, and casting prismatic shadows along the walls. She sat wrapped in blankets all day, beside the sack containing the head of Cosmas, whom she now kept close, because she felt like they were in this together, and also because he reminded her of her brother. She watched Mr. Capellatio, who read, took notes, screamed at people, and laughed. Most of all, he spent his time writing long tracts on page after page of parchment, that he then scrutinized furiously. Often he threw them away, and other times he locked them in a trunk. Water seeped through cracks in the old wagon, and she tried to sleep most of the day, but the shuddering and bumping kept her awake. And sometimes, when she opened her eyes, she caught Mr. Capellatio gazing at her intently, and perhaps sympathetically. But she could not really tell, because she couldn't understand his face. It was written in a difficult language. The more she heard and saw of him, the less she understood. But forgiveness had been stirring within her a long while, perhaps since the moment he'd executed Argento, and when he looked at her, she could not help but look back. He was a moon, pulling on the ocean of her pity. He was afraid, and she sensed that the first act of her womanhood would be to comfort him. Soon, she would reach for him, not the other way around, and she knew then that was what he had been waiting for. At a field of skeletal ruins, they camped for a day and a night. Still everywhere was flat, wide, gaping holes and rusted cylindrical ruins, metal scars in the fields. She overheard someone beyond the wagon saying, "Arkansas," and for the first time she wondered what that word meant. "Arkansas." She glanced at Mr. Capellatio, in bed with closed eyes. He nevertheless chuckled. "Wrong. Still Missouri. Miserable Missouri. Fools never know where we are. I've a state sense that's never failed me." He rolled over. "Today's my birthday. Did you know that?" He stretched his arms above his head and yawned. "Do you know how old I am? How old are you?"
15.
"Are you sure?"
"My birthday was the day before."
She trailed off and looked around the wagon.
"The day before you took me."
"That doesn't mean you know how old you are." She stared at him.
"I'm 15.
He shrugged. "I was born on the anniversary of the launch of Cassini to Saturn. Today is a very important day, astronomically speaking. The book you have listed out, it's all there. It comes together just so. like a fairy tale. He noticed her eyeing him skeptically. Oh, I've read that book you have. Imagine that. It's about me, Sugar Plum. I am one blessed son of a bitch. Nothing else you can call me. I can do no wrong. He thoughtfully fiddled with his collarbone. But you've never read the book, eh? Even though you had it. Outside, people rattled cooking pots and laughed, and someone was singing. Well, he said at last, what counts is what we do with our blessings. Right. She remained quiet. He took a deep breath. What I'm saying is, I never get what I really want. She drew her knees to her chest.
What do you really want?
Ah, do you really want to know?
No. No.
A drop of sweat fell down the center of her ribcage, between her breasts, and she realized she was trembling, and Mr. Capellatio swung his legs around and sat upright, and light seemed to pour from his mouth when he smiled. That was his knifing smile. No, I thought not. Do you have a gift for me?
No,
she whispered. He blinked. Well, I have one for you. A secret.
Why?
Why not? He bent forward and pushed a few of the hanging charms away, holding them back while he seemed to consider. Then he let them plunge before him, a jingling curtain. He spoke, and his accent had disappeared. She tried to hear it, but couldn't. Was she used to it? Or had it vanished? He said, I know you think you're running away sometime, once you've ridden this train back to Florida. Do you think I'm a fool? Do you think I took you up just to lose you? Do you think I axed your brother for fun? Tell me what you think. He blithely inspected his knuckles. All the blood drained from her face. She felt it slide into her heart, where it thumped about like a suffocating fish. Tell me. When I go off to do my magic, do you think I'm not spying on you? He reached past her suddenly and grabbed the sack with Cosmas's head, upended it, and dumped Cosmas onto the bed. The glittering forehead hexagram caught the light and shot it all over the wagon. It's called a third eye, Queen Stupid. It lets you see. Well, it lets me see. Even your idiot ugly brother could do a spell like the third eye. Thanks, by the way, he said, looking upward with phony gratefulness. Saved me the trouble. She could not stop blinking.
How could he know? Was he just guessing, gauging her reaction? He couldn't read her thoughts. She knew he couldn't. It wasn't possible. Was it?
I'm just telling you, he continued more softly, not to run away, because I'll always know where you are, unless you want to destroy good old Cosmas here. He extended the head to her, dangled it by its straw hair, and swung it a little for effect. Do you? Seems an awful shame to waste him. He gave his life for you. He's not the only one.
Her words were barely audible.
Are you lying?
He shrugged.
Why would I lie? To you, I mean.
It sounded petulant even to her, and she sat in stunned silence for a long moment.
No crying. None, she told herself.
The silence became an awkward void, and when a tear rolled over her cheek, he rubbed it away with his thumb, and he was sorry, she knew. He'd felt scared, that was all, and he wanted her to be scared, too.
Why did you have to kill him?
She asked thickly. He appeared to think, and then faced her. She wondered if such tension meant he loved her. He dropped Cosmas into his bag, dusted off his hands.
Well, it's not like you could have done it.
He said it honestly, and gratitude jolted her like static, hot and surprising, and when he stalked away to sulk, she missed him. Dark night. She crawled into his bed and into his arms, and he held her and he smelled like rain. Hours passed. He stroked her hair. He ran his hands down her spine and around her neck, and he kissed her a little, not much, enough to make her feel protected. He was awake. She was awake. All night, and she said,
Thank you.
For what?
She buried her face in his hair,
More time passed, and she asked, "Will it be different with you than with him?"
"I don't know," he said.
She felt his hand trace the star-shaped scar on the inside of her thigh.
"Probably. The difference is that I'm only going to hurt you on the inside."
A new happiness had settled over him, and he seemed relieved. She wondered if he'd been testing himself. How long until she trusted him? Would she ever? A king must inspire trust, and for her, a miracle too. She'd chosen this, or felt like she had. He needed her, to keep him calm, to map out every one of 1,000 horrible deaths that might befall him in the coming months or years. He was afraid of his destiny, chokingly, overwhelmingly afraid, and suddenly it didn't matter whether he believed in magic, or she did, or if it was real, or if her mother was right, and they were all just fools walking in a pointless, bloody parade toward the end of time. Her eyes were open. She could run or not. She could love him or not. She could miss her brother or hate him forever. It was all going to hurt.
"You know what I really wish?"
Mr. Capellatio asked wistfully.
"What?"
"That I'd never been born. That would be really great."
She took a careful breath.
"I think you're going to die by boiling oil. Our 7th son will have you fried and fed to crows."
"Our." She felt him smile. Sad, happy, deep, and dark.
"Oh, Sugar Plum. I didn't know you cared."
Chapter 2 Ears. Marvel Whiteside Parsons walked across the palace courtyard in the morning rain and paused for a moment to feel the drops on his cheeks. They wept sparsely from a marbled sky, and briefly he stopped to watch as they hurtled into the puddles gathering in the cart ruts. He'd once read that the oceans had formed drop by drop from infinitesimally small amounts of water carried inside meteors until they struck the earth and released their contents. Each droplet a minor cataclysm. Men have held such strange notions of the world, Marvel thought, and wiped the water from his forehead. Marvel had not spent much time thinking of nature. Rarely did he have occasion to experience it. He was a busy man, perhaps the busiest at the Cape. Certainly, he was the most troubled. Although he had once crossed the continent on foot, he'd long ago counted himself lucky for that feat of survival, and had never since tested his mettle against the elements. The elements could evaporate, for all they mattered to his life. The stars above were only lights to him now, no longer signifiers of the divine. Marvel passed his days signing letters. He appeared in public to grant blessings. He presided over beheadings. He advised King Michael. He concocted potions, and he managed all those matters that King Michael did not wish to manage. These were many. Marvel was tired. And he had begun thinking of the weather again. He could not help himself. He would be leaving soon. Marvel Whiteside Parsons was the High Priest of Cape Canaveral, Hierophant, and Head Magician. Born 50 and some years before in Dread, Kansas, the center of the world, he knew he was growing old. And yet still he felt like a younger man. Perhaps it was destiny that he should be robust. By design, his birth had taken place at the holiest spot in the holiest place in all the world, inside the Black Watchtower. His mother was a descendant of Hulda, the mother prophetess who had given the world the primary law, Wonderblood. His father had been a holy monk, one of the dark priests who prayed continually for the end of the world. Marvel was a man entirely of the deathscapes. He embodied their torment, so to speak, the way other men carried family names. His entire personage was to have been like those flat lands, alive with death, seething with righteous terror, unyielding and impartial. But it had not happened that way. Though Marvel was born to be a saving king from the great plain where the ruin of the world had begun, the true king, in fact, he was not. He was not even in Kansas. He looked down the path at the busy courtyard. When people noticed him, they bowed perfunctorily. He often went about the palace grounds alone. He looked up again as another droplet splashed on his forehead. He was supposed to interrogate a prisoner this morning, a job he preferred to delay. The weather today, a spate of seasonal November drear. Rain had been falling from a sky the color of a kidney for how long? Maybe no more than a day, but if he were crossing the land, even a day of rain would be miserable. He must have the correct supplies for days and days of rain. And cold. The air today was uncomfortably windy, and the gusts spat cold water blown in from the deathscapes. Marvel did hate the cold. He had grown to adolescence in the frigid stone rooms of Hulda's Black Tower. Here at the Cape, cold was never truly cold, but over time he had grown more sensitive to it. He trudged through the courtyard, his black shoes dirtying in the wet paste of straw and sawdust. And there, look, a carpet thrown over a puddle. For who? His daughter Allison, perhaps. Oh, most certainly for her. Michael would never consider using a carpet to cross a puddle. What a waste, Marvel thought, of a perfectly nice carpet, and how like Allison to demand something so frivolous. He shook his head and blamed her, although he had no evidence. He was unfair to his daughter. It was not her fault she was as vapid as the deathscapes were vast. Marvel had not been a good father. Where had he gone wrong? To look at her was a delight, but to listen to her, Marvel could hardly stand it. She thought only of sport and smoking. She may have resembled Marvel's pious mother, Nasa Whiteside with her dark hair and round face, but she embodied everything he had wasted of himself during his years at the Cape. His virtue, his talent, his devotion. She embarrassed him. But he was being petty. It was the weather, yes, his boots squelching in the mud. That sound made his skin crawl, the plump glug-glug of mud sucking at him. Something about it only just sickening. He was not by any means a precious man. He had some time ago discarded all the fine clothes his high office had afforded him, and now wore only a plain brown cassock. He went barefoot to his prayers in warm weather. Marvel had shed nearly all the material trappings of his office over the years, yet couldn't contain his annoyance at this muddy courtyard. The king's courtyard. Did no one believe they were worthy of a clean and tidy courtyard any longer? Where was the man to lay down more straw? Marvel pulled his foot from the mud again and sighed. When Marvel had first encountered the countryside outlying Cape Canaveral, he was struck by its utter inhospitality. And he had come from Kansas, dread of the continent. He had been walking nearly a month. He was 14, perilously thin when he arrived, dirty, like a scrambling vermin, his exhausted heart clawed at his insides. But still he lurched with wonder as he drew closer to the palace compound. He had crossed two stone bridges on pylons sunk into the shallow channel between the mainland and the Cape, their surfaces studded with fossilized shells and rocks, coral limestone, he learned later. When at last he sat in the sand at the Atlantic shore, he sank to his knees. The sea here was so shallow and so lovely, like stained glass, with shallow panes of pale blue, its variegated green depths and its flesh-pink sandbars gracefully lifting themselves like elbows above the water. The young Marvel had never seen anything so strange and darkly beautiful to his eyes, which had only ever beheld wide fields, dirt, skies. To his left and behind him was a sparse row of broken hexagrams, ancient cement markers in the scrub. These were the old shuttle launch pads, watched over now by palace guards with machetes. Still more patrolled in wagons drawn by mules. What they looked for, he hadn't known then, but they hadn't stopped him or paid him even a second glance as he'd passed them on his way to the water. Now those guards did his bidding, or rather, ignored it. This muddy courtyard, he sighed. The interrogation chambers were housed in Canaveral Tower. Its height was legend. The cylinder rose upward and upward, like a thin band of water siphoned into the sky, the most impressive construction yet built during the eon of pain. This was the spot where men had touched outer space. Marvel vividly recalled seeing the palace compound for the first time. He was a man tormented by a keen memory. embarrassingly old when at last he understood that many people simply forgot things, or, stranger still, didn't care enough to notice them in the first place. His first visions of the Cape were burned into his mind's eye, perhaps more dynamic now than ever before. After all, he was preparing to leave. He would cross the continent again soon. Marvel had first arrived at the Cape during the season when the carnivals returned to pay their tributes. Just beyond their lean-to camps, their cookpots filled with gruels, their casks of germed waters, was the great wall that surrounded the entire palace compound. 10 men high, encrusted with broken glass, greens and blues and browns cobbled together into a jagged mosaic that seemed at once to be depicting all the events in remembered history. Pieces of glass were thrust with their edges bared at the outer world, a spiked halo. Marvel knew that behind the wall lurked what he had come for, the seat of the magical world. But nothing seemed magical here anymore. Not to Marvel. Not the wind from the sea or the glow of the stars. Certainly not this mud. He had not progressed much further along the path before he noticed another of his staff's failures. A sleepy guard stood a fair distance away, one of the many posted to oversee the daily courtyard market. Merchants from beyond the walls came with their wares and sold them in booths. Magicked heads, jewelry, leather. People pushed carts with wood for fires. Women carried water. Men yanked horses through the mud. Magicians shook their girdles of talismans. Still more carried fish and flesh and fabrics and pieces of found metal, balanced in gigantic baskets upon their heads. Courtiers, the families of the Cape, who had lived here 1,000 years, mingled in their finery and blew each other 5 kisses, the greeting their station demanded. Ochre robes, moonstone collars, blue glass rings on every finger in homage to the heavenly bodies. They were arrayed in splendor, while their finely dressed children scrapped with each other and chased dogs. But Marvel's eyes were drawn to the young-looking guard. He stood beneath the eave of a booth. His uniform was all wrong. It might not even have been palace issue. He seemed almost comatose. But as Marvel watched, he snatched an orange from a passing cart. Without offering payment, he peeled it and began to eat. The whole fruit was gone in a few bites, the peel tossed underfoot. The guard ground it into the mud. Marvel stopped, frowned. The man would need to be reprimanded. There was no one to do it but Marvel. He realized abruptly that he hated to be in charge. When had that changed? At one time he had enjoyed it, craved it. Now he wished he could leave the guard to his stupid fruit. Should a man not have the dignity of sorting out those ethics on his own? But it was not possible. Others had seen Marvel crossing the courtyard. What if they had also seen the guard steal the fruit? What if someone had seen Marvel see the guard steal and do nothing? He clenched his jaw. He took a weary step off the path, but at that moment a trumpet sounded the public prayer. It was led not by Marvel, but by the royal pardoness, Green Butterfly. Marvel turned from the guard, grateful but then at once reluctant for the distraction. The pardoness emerged, shrouded. None of her skin was visible, only clouds of weightless fabric topped by a crown of polished green rocks, like tombstones, or teeth. Her face entirely covered by a pale diaphanous silk, drops of water pitted the fabric here and there. She revealed herself upon her balcony for a few moments every day in order to assure the people there still existed a link between themselves and the divine. Green Butterfly stretched her slender hands over them all each morning, in sunshine and rain. She was a direct descendant of a man who had walked on the moon. A feeling of peace did emanate from the act, if one had a mind to feel it. Often, Marvel did not. There were people who said Green Butterfly lived in a room paneled entirely in opals, that she kept the finger bones from every soul she pardoned. He was sure those things weren't true, but the people liked her nonetheless. Though she was now so frail, her voice was nearly impossible to hear. Though no one had seen her face in years, though she rarely granted pardons, still, she represented goodness, kindness, even love. The spitting weather drowned her voice. The people in the courtyard stared at her anyway. Most of them. They knew what she would say, as did Marvel. She said the same thing every day. More important was to be seen, looking at her. He supposed many of them admired her clothing, her headpiece, for he had authorized those, and knew how much they cost. Others were simply glad to stop working for a few moments. A few might even have wanted to feel her warmth, though from this distance it flickered like a candle across a bedroom. Marvel stopped along with them, splashes of rain on their faces together while they strained to listen. She opened her arms, silks streaming off them. A few murmurs, nothing discernible. Marvel knew the words because he'd written them. He found his mouth saying them, though he could not see her lips. One of his first acts as Hierophant had been to change all the traditional prayers. He had been young and passionate then. He could remember many things, but could hardly remember himself. Who had he been in those days? Then a trumpet blast barreled from another tower, signifying the end of the prayer. The Pardoness bowed to them all. She disappeared back into her chamber, and for a moment no one moved. The rain fell, and an indifferent silence filled by the sound of shoes shifting in mud, a mule shaking its mane. At last a woman sneezed, and the racket of the courtyard trading booths began once again. Marvel's eyes fell at once on the offending guard again. He slumped against a pole. His chin nodded toward his chest. Marvel sighed again and went toward him, nearly knocked over in his haste by a handcart full of citrus greenery, likely meant for a courtier's bedroom. He weaved away from the cart and swore under his breath as the wheel splashed mud on his cassock. He was not angry, but it felt right to act as though he were. He poked the guard in the stomach when he reached him. The man gasped and doubled over. On the ground lay the orange peel. The guard stood up angrily and glared at Marvel, not a shred of recognition in his eyes.
"What the hell's wrong with you, eh?"
Marvel folded his arms.
"Why have you stolen from your countrymen?"
"Who the hell are you?"
"More importantly, why have you not addressed me honorably?"
The guard seemed confused. His face was unshaven, patches of wheat-colored hair growing out of tanned skin. Something about him off. That uniform, up close, looked years out of date. He shook his head slightly.
"Don't play stupid. I saw you," Marvel barked.
Sir,
I'm no one, sir."
Marvel paused. The man looked even more baffled. Marvel said,
"Do you know who I am?"
He had a deep voice, almost croaking, and knew he sounded intimidating. He was also tall, somewhat hulking, and only just a bit overweight. In his cassock he looked regal, though the garment was plain.
Anyone should know who he was, Marvel thought, annoyed. His image was circulated.
The guard's eyes darted left, then right. His head sat upon his neck like a goblet bowl.
"Obviously someone important."
He tried to smile, and mostly succeeded. He was a head shorter than Marvel, soft-skinned and loosely jointed.
"I'm new to the job. Please forgive me."
His accent was foreign. He might indeed be new. Marvel didn't concern himself with hiring guards. He had men for that.
But this man could be a spy.
Something about him bothered Marvel, apart from the stealing and the sleeping.
Was it his clothing after all?
With a thought came an unwelcome tremor.
Who would send a spy wearing out-of-date clothing?
Marvel could think of one place.
Kansas.
But how could the monks at the Black Watchtower have learned of his plans to return when he had told no one?
Impossible.
He leaned back on his heels and smirked, as he often did when he wasn't sure what to do. His presence was large. Usually this was enough to cow his adversaries.
"Where is your firearm?"
Marvel asked after a moment.
"My what?"
"Your gun. You're an elite guard. That's the uniform you're wearing, even if it's old. Or did you not know?"
"They didn't give me one. A gun, I mean,"
the man replied.
"Who is they?"
The guard shrugged.
"Whoever's in charge of handing out weapons. Like I said, I'm new.
The younger man looked at him buoyantly, something striking about his eyes. It may have been cockiness. He didn't know who Marvel was, after all. How long since anyone had looked at Marvel that way? That sent another tremor through him. The man turned his head when he realized Marvel was still staring. The moment had stretched on inappropriately.
I just came here a few days ago. The guard shrugged. I asked for a job, and they gave me one. I didn't ask for a weapon. Should I have?
I see you have a knife right there. Marvel pointed to the guard's belt.
That was mine. From before.
The man's eyes were green. His hair was pale brown, cut poorly. Marvel rubbed his own chin. He hadn't shaved that day or the day before. Suddenly he stepped back, aware of the gray in his beard, the other man's proximity.
Who hired you again?
Oh, I don't remember his name.
He was middle height,
the guard said, then more eagerly.
I used to go with the carnivals, if that's why you're staring at me like that.
He gestured to his clothes.
I know I look bad.
Carnival men can be difficult to reason with. We don't often hire them as guards.
Marvel raised his eyebrow.
You really don't know who I am, do you?
Another cart jostled them as it passed. A palm frond fell from its overloaded basket and lay beside the orange peel. The guard's smile turned sheepish. He shook his head. Surely a spy would know who he was. Unless, of course, it was all an act. He crossed his arms.
Which carnival did you come from? I asked.
The younger man shrugged. Pale light filled the guard's eyes from the side, and with a jolt, Marvel realized he had not looked at anyone for a long time. Not really. He was thoroughly enjoying the experience. His gaze fell on a tiny sack just peeking from the folds of the man's tunic. It hung from a cord tied to his belt, no bigger than a money purse. The guard brushed it with his hand, but that was all. A long moment passed.
I got work in the carnivals.
That was all, the guard said finally.
It's better than nothing, eh? This was the only head I ever made.
The life of a guard will suit you better, then.
I think so.
A silence opened between them. It occurred to Marvel that this man might have spent all his life outside. His cheeks were roughened and red. Even if he was not from a carnival, which Marvel suspected, he had most likely walked long miles to get here. It was a hard way across the continent. Marvel had traveled it. When at last the other man began to fidget, Marvel said,
I'm Marvel Parsons.
Oh.
The man knew the name. He cleared his throat.
Oh, he said again. Many apologies. It wasn't... I didn't think you would be dressed so...
He waved his hand.
You know, I think you're a spy. I'm almost sure. I might have you thrown in prison.
The man smiled again, while shaking his head. Perhaps he enjoyed being ridiculed. Marvel had met other men who did.
But, Marvel went on, I like you. If you've crossed the continent lately, I could see my way to a compromise.
He shrugged.
Are you a spy?
Never.
Did you cross the deathscapes to get here?
Young and audacious and beautiful in the way that impudence can render a young man beautiful, the guard stood a bit taller and replied,
On my own. Without so much as a mule. No sickness, no death.
He bowed at last.
Your Majesty.
Marvel found himself nodding. There would be time to discover who had sent him and why. But before then, Marvel would hear about the deathscapes. He had dealt with many smarter men than this. In these, his final days at the Cape, when his desperation to return to Kansas had all but transformed him from statesman back into a sort of cautious zealot, Marvel had begun once more to dream. He thrust out his hand, opened it, and waited until the guard placed his knife in his palm. Marvel clapped him on the back. The rain had stopped falling. But when? He hadn't noticed. He must become better about noticing the weather.
Walk with me, young man. We have a few things in common, Marvel said.
sticking the knife into his own belt and steering the guard toward Knavril Tower, toward the jail. He would show him an interrogation. He would show him the jail in all its white horror, and then, perhaps, he would ask him again if he were a spy. Or perhaps not. Marvel could simply kill him after he learned how the man had crossed the deathscapes, if, say, he was in possession of a map. He had done worse things. When Marvel was born in Kansas, his mother, the nun, laid him in a black stone cradle. She presented him with a swaddling blanket fit for a king, a sheer black cloth inscribed with gold thread that spelled out his name in stars. Later he was told the heavens themselves would have mirrored it, had he proven worthy. Alas, Marvel had been an unkingly boy from his first breath, which emerged reluctantly from clogged airways. Marvel had been born dead. He came to life when at last a midwife held him up to declare him lifeless, as though he had considered her offer and rejected it. His mother cried with relief, but those tears turned quickly to despair. The mystagogue at the watchtower, highest priest of the Kansas sect, declared Marvel deficient the instant he saw him limply breathing in the cold birthing room, barely squirming in that starry blanket. He turned the baby around, so Marvel was no longer facing him, and handed him back to the midwife, who handed him to his mother, who stared up at the mystagogue in awe of his cruelty. "By rights," said the mystagogue, "Marvel should be thrown from the tower." But his mother was a nun, after all, and more importantly, a descendant of Huldah the prophetess. Which made Marvel also a descendant of Huldah. Marvel would be educated as a monk, no more and no less, and Nassa Whiteside should be grateful for that small mercy. He became ordinary in those first instants of his life, and his stricken mother became a failure. Nevertheless, the account of his birth cheered him in a strange way. Even as an infant, he had been a complicated person, one capable of bearing tremendous weight, as well as casting it off. Defying expectation was in his blood. That was his destiny. He had faith in that. He still had that swaddling blanket somewhere, shoved into a wooden crate and stored away. From time to time, Marvel enjoyed imagining himself from the vantage point of history, which stretches onward until the morality of events is winnowed until it appears to be fate, one action begetting the next, and so on. Progress. This was the place where treachery and failure transformed themselves. What once seemed terrible could become courageous if given enough time. Marvel imagined that one day his sins might be tallied as virtues, that time could render him honorable, as he knew himself to be. He would leave the Cape. He would leave them all, even his own daughter, the Queen, to their empty frivolities, their misguided readings of holy texts, to their gentle, ineffectual king, who was not the true king. He would go back to Kansas. He would start again, where he'd started in the first place. It was the only way he knew how to save himself. Above the jail that housed all dissidents, Knavril Tower spun sharply upward. The heart clot of the palace compound, of such terrific height and magnificence that even the macabre collection of corpses exposed on the eastern parapet could not detract from its excellence. The tower shone with a sun-sharpened triumph, both terrifying and cheerful. Together with its five flanking minarets, it represented the shuttles and their glorious passages off the world, and waited in bannered anticipation for their return. Marvel and the young guard entered the jail through a plain door in the side of the tower. The jail was not wet or cold, which was itself an achievement of engineering, given the high water table at the Cape, but all through it ran a smell of despair and death and rotting corpses from the bodies exposed on the compound's high parapets. The jail's walls and floor and even all the washstands in the cells were painted white. Marvel's idea. He had conceived of it as a maddening reminder of the light and air outside, but additionally, it served to give the prisoners an endless amount of menial work, for the cells were required to remain spotless, and the prisoners given only a few soft rags with which to clean them. Any visitor's feet left smudgy imprints on the floor. He went with the young guard straight down a set of steps, metal white, perforated with many coin-sized elliptical holes, descending in wider spirals until the staircase ended at a metal doorway. There they stood in awkward silence, until Marvel used the knocker to rap 5 times. The door opened, and that smell washed over them. Fecal and rotting. Each cell had a drain, and each drain was a horror. Marvel had grown used to it. The guard looked on the verge of fainting. Marvel smiled, shrugged. The jailer's face, when it appeared, was like a tree trunk, the bulbous nose and knotty lips eruptions on the rough skin. He was neither old nor young, but struck Marvel as both bored and uncruel, qualities he supposed were desirable in a jailer.
"Here for a prisoner."
Marvel withdrew a small bit of paper from his pocket and unrolled it. He and the guard stepped into the anteroom, where the jailer had a 3-legged stool set up in a corner, and next to it a bucket of oysters, some shells on the floor.
"William Tygo, the second."
"Right," said the jailer.
He held a brain-pink liquid in a thick, dirty glass mug.
"I put him in the last cell. A real stick up his ass, that one."
His eyes like wild malarial marbles. How could one bear this stench all day? The jailer seemed to have long ago lost some essential function of his brain. Marvel wondered how anyone could spend a lifetime sitting feet away from ranting lunatics. Yet apparently the jailer found his posting unobjectionable. He had performed his duties competently for many years. Marvel and the guard followed him through the anteroom into the winding circular hallway that housed the cells. This was the most intense displeasure of visiting the jail. The incarcerated men and women called out to Marvel before the jailer shushed them with a poke from the back end of his pike. They screamed their innocence, threatened to have Marvel's daughter killed, insulted every feature upon his own body and hers. He didn't listen. The vulgarities had bothered him, until they had stopped bothering him, and he thought now that there was nothing the prisoners could say that could hurt him. Their words and spit misted him, but it was only a hygienic nuisance. The young guard swayed uncertainly when the prisoners began their chorus. He had a boy's way about him, a boy's eagerness to please. It was not irritating, though in others this quality could seem calculated. He attempted to cover his alarm with a look of nonchalance until Marvel rapped him again on the shoulders encouragingly.
"We're in this together now."
He pushed the man in front of him. After hesitating a moment, the guard walked ahead. Not too many months before, a woman had lunged at Marvel through her cell's bars. She'd starved herself until she fit between them, and had thrown herself on him like a cat of the jungle leaping from a tree, tearing the sleeve of his cassock from shoulder to wrist. Her face a fire pit of insanity. Marvel was exhausted of ordering executions. Instead of killing her, he'd had her forcibly fed and freed the next day. From his own apartments on top of Endeavor Tower, one of the other spires, he'd watched the jailer cast her into the sunlight, wearing nothing but the rags she'd arrived in months before. He couldn't see her face, but she turned in a slow circle, blind to the commotion of the courtyard market. After a few moments, a servant woman brought her a brown dress, laced it up right over her rags, and held out a pair of shoes for her to take. The woman threw the shoes to the ground and kicked dirt over them. After the servant left, the woman returned to the shoes, dusted them off, and slid her feet into them. Marvel did not often free traitors. He let that woman go because she was too insane even to question the circumstances that had set her free. Marvel had grown tired of exercising his power. Even acts of mercy wearied him. He had watched the woman's expulsion from the jail from the safety of his balcony, uncertain of what he hoped to observe. Their eyes had not locked. She hadn't gulped the fresh air like a person thirsty to live. She simply went out through the nearest gate and drifted away.
"What's your name?"
Marvel asked the young guard as they walked down the hallway, over the whoops and wails of traitors.
The jailer clanged his pike on the bars, screaming at the prisoners for silence. The young guard winced at the racket, as though sprayed with cold water.
Juniper, sir.
That's a woman's name.
Yes, he agreed. No one's ever mentioned that to me before.
Marvel snorted.
I couldn't care less what you are called. But why would a spy choose a woman's name?
Because I'm not a spy.
Ah.
Marvel folded his arms behind his back. The man's knife was still in his belt.
Forgive me.
If I were a spy, you'd lock me in here with the loonies, right?
Or worse.
Marvel shrugged.
You may have caught me in a season of tolerance.
He pushed a thumbnail into the tough skin around his forefinger, watching the thick callus spring back after he'd pressed it. Suddenly, he was imagining that wide land between Florida and Kansas again, those endless, spoiled fields grown over now with grasses and trees, but just as deadly as in centuries past. The precarious passage over the safe roads. He dreamt of walking the spindles through the wilderness, obscurely marked by scratches on tree trunks placed there by the walking doctors, which reminded him to unfold the paper with the prisoner's name on it again. William Tygo II, walking doctor. He closed the paper and said to the guard,
You're not from a carnival, I can tell. You're too educated.
So, he nodded to himself,
You've been lying.
I went to the carnival once I was already grown. I wasn't raised there. Marvel smiled and shrugged again and rubbed his own unshaven face thoughtfully. Still, the jailer walked onward and they followed. The hall was long. Diffuse afternoon light poured through lozenge-shaped ventilation slits that lined the cell's upper walls. The dungeon was in fact only one level underground and received significant natural light. Finally, the jailer stopped, gesturing to the very last cell with the sharp point of his pike.
Good luck with that one, yeah? He's a genuine article. An old-fashioned fanatic if ever I met one.
He didn't even bother to glance in at the prisoner before he turned and left. No one shouted at him as he ambled back to his post. The prisoner sat on the white floor of his cell, his back to them. He wore a suit of what must have once been a brilliant blue, a long jacket. Quite expensive, probably. Now the whole getup was covered in filth. Although it was so dirty, Marvel could hardly believe all that grime could have come from the prison. He guessed the man had been picked up in fairly dire condition. Jail may even have been a mercy. So it was for many. Marvel leaned closer to the bars in order to see the side of the prisoner's face, since he had not yet turned around. The man's hair was tucked into his collar, obscuring the view. Marvel glanced over his shoulder at Juniper, who looked back blankly. Marvel coughed.
So, I'm here at last. This is your hearing, prisoner. You'd better turn around for it.
The prisoner tugged his ratty hair down over his ears. It was long, after the fashion of the carnival executioners, and black, loose on the sides and wrapped tightly in back with string, so it formed a pigtail of sorts.
I refuse to speak. He said sharply. You're all idiots here, raving at the goddamn sky. This is the most humiliating thing that's ever happened to me. You have no right to hold me in this jail. None of you do.
The prisoner's voice was unaccented. To Marvel's ear, he sounded local. Only a walking doctor. No terrible threat. Just a routine dissident. Marvel examined his nail beds once again.
Do you know who I am?
I can guess. The prisoner still did not turn. You've come to torture me, I suppose. Nothing I say matters, but I'll still say it. I don't have anything to answer for. Not to you.
I'm not here to torture you. Marvel inspected his knuckles. But I do enjoy a show.
Beside him, Juniper remained quiet. Marvel tapped on the bars.
I'm here to establish your guilt.
So this is my trial?
He chuckled.
Trials don't exist except in books, my friend. You should have received a letter requesting you desist practicing contra-magical surgeries. You got the letter. Then if you still refuse, and I gather you've refused, A warrant for your execution is issued. You are captured. I establish your guilt. That's the part of the process we're completing today. You're lucky because I am a fair man. He paused. At least today I will be. A snort. So after this I'll be executed? It's the responsibility of my office to punish traitors. And what is your office? Who are you? Marvel Parsons.
Marvel's words seemed to hang oddly in the air. It took a moment for them to float into the cell and land on the prisoner. The prisoner stood and turned around. He was much shorter than Marvel. He couldn't have been 5.5 feet tall.
Marvel Parsons. The Hierophant?
Marvel began a reflexive nod, but as the prisoner moved, his hair fell away from his ears. Or, the place where his ears had been. At once, the warmth drained from Marvel, as from a limb held above the head.
Your ears, he demanded. What happened to them?
The prisoner drifted nearer the bars of the cell, tugging loose strands back over the holes. Under that large, very blue coat and dirty, low-cut undergarment, his collarbones threatened to pierce the skin. And yet Marvel took in the wholeness of his appearance with just a glance, because he could hardly tear his eyes from those ear holes. The prisoner twisted his lips to the side.
That? Oh, that was a punishment. I got on with my life.
He seemed to speak from another dimension. Marvel could not stop staring. The prisoner made a sad grimace.
I can still hear. It's not as bad as it looks, for the love of God. I'd like to think you've seen much worse.
Marvel realized he was not breathing. He had been sure he'd never see that particular punishment again. The prisoner tilted his head, still fiddling with his hair. He stared intently at Marvel.
What's the problem? I thought you were going to execute me. A bit of disfigurement, is that appalling to you? Or,
he lifted his eyebrows,
or else you're from Kansas?
Of course I'm not.
Marvel forced himself to speak at a normal volume. It was a fact that no one from the Cape actually knew where Marvel Whiteside Parsons had come from originally. The two kingdoms were rivals in both politics and piety, but centuries ago the Cape had become the capital. When at 14, Marvel ran away, he had gone to the Cape because he believed that Leander, King Michael's father, was the true king. With all his heart he had believed that. Only the mad monks at the Black Watchtower still thought the king would come to Kansas. But Kansas was the seat of the disease, where the eon of bloodshed and pain had started in the cows and soil. Why should the king who would save them all be born in the place that had ruined the world? The endless reading and study the mystagogue required had convinced Marvel that his entire denomination, all the monks and nuns and ascetics at Hulda's stronghold, the Black Watchtower, were pursuing a folly. The true king would not appear in Kansas, ever. Waiting for him there was pure vanity. The true king would reign at the Cape, where the shuttles had existed so many years ago. What a fool Marvel had been in his youth. He tried to wrench his gaze from the prisoner's missing ears. They were sure proof that the man had been a monk in Kansas. And yet, no one had used that punishment in Kansas in generations. Except, of course, the mystagogue himself. And only upon his personal retinue of zealous and dangerous monks. But everyone knew the mystagogue was dead. That he had been dead for a very long time. Exactly as long as Marvel had been gone, in fact. If the mystagogue were not dead, Marvel could not go back to Kansas. Not after what he had done, though the mystagogue had deserved it. He narrowed his eyes at the prisoner.
Who did that to you?
Now the prisoner was as interested in Marvel as Marvel was in him. His eyes flashed.
Who do you think?
Marvel would not say the mystagogue's name or title aloud and give himself away. He tilted his face back and smirked again. Juniper looked at both of them and asked,
What's going on?
Yes. What is going on? Your paper says you are a walking doctor.
The prisoner drew himself up into his too large jacket.
I am. My patients live. Almost always.